top of this. That's it, a good dose of Oxford history on the Oxford History Podcast. In this podcast, we're going to explore Oxford's 20th century history, which has shaped the Oxford we know today. But we're going to start here and now in my own college, Oriel.
In actual fact, Oriel is really more of a nickname than anything else. The official title of the college is the House of the Blessed Mary the Virgin in Oxford. But at some point, it acquired this rather odd nickname. I'm going to try and find out why and how, and see if I can find out some more about the history of this fascinating college.
It is a curious name, isn't it? I wonder where it comes from. Perhaps the librarian would know? Let's go and see if we can find out.
Well, I found out that the name Oriel comes from a large building that was the size of First Quad. It's a very big building, and it was called L'Oriel. Right. And this building was given to the college in the 14th century, just after it had been founded. And there was probably what we think of as an oriel window in it. Oriel comes from aureolum, meaning a balcony, or a it doesn't necessarily mean the window part of it. And this is where some explanations go wrong. People think that it comes from the oriel window, which is in front of the college at the moment. But it was from this whole building, which was called L'Oriel.
And that building contained an oriel window?
It had an oriel window somewhere in it, but we don't have any pictures of it. We don't know what it looked like. It was taken down quite early on, after the college had acquired it. And the new buildings, as we know them, were put up in the 17th century.
So that's interesting, Ed. So the name doesn't actually come from the window, it comes from another building that was
called. Yes, it comes from the building which probably had an oriel window in it somewhere. We have nothing to go on as far as the look of the building was concerned, but we think it must have contained an oriel window along with the bay. I've heard quite a lot of things in my time here.
Now that sounds interesting.
I've been told that in the middle part of the 20th century, when students and others from the United States used to come over, the fellows and the dean at that time would play a joke on them because they didn't know Oxford ways, and they were under the impression that they would have to have a ceremony performed for them to join the college. So the dean dressed up, this is what I hear, and performed a ceremony, and then they were content. Also, people don't generally know that in 1949 there was a fire in the senior library in the roof. An engineer had left a spark in the roof, and it completely burst into flames during the night and burned fiercely, and they had to call the fire engines. But undergraduates from Oriel and surrounding colleges, I've had people tell me this, came and helped to get the books out of the building. So only 300 books altogether were destroyed by the fire. The ceiling had to be completely restored, and we lost one of the globes, the ancient globes that were in there, and some of the manuscripts which were lying in the cases on display. And it was made to look as if it was new, but the fact that so many of the books were kept and not burned was due to people who formed a human chain and started taking the books and other effects out of the building. It wouldn't be allowed these days because of health and safety, but they did it in 1949.
Yes, and that's a good story, I suppose, of the college community coming together to...
Exactly, and surrounding colleges as well.
So it was, of course, the last college to admit women, and it's got a reputation for, in the past, being a bit... conservative and not
yes.
necessarily very friendly, but
yes.
that obviously.
But I think it has regained its reputation for friendliness now.
Well, that's all very interesting. But if we're really going to understand Oxford's past and what it was like to live here, surely a good place to start would be to ask somebody who actually lived through it in decades gone by. David Nearer is the acting chaplain, and as I understand it, he first came to Oriel half a century ago.
I matriculated as an undergraduate in October 1966, which is 50 years ago this coming October, which is a rather scary thought. I came to Oriel from Merchant Taylor's School in Northwood to read classics. The reason I came to Oriel was, of all the colleges in Oxford, was that my father was here. He was a graduate student in the late 1920s, in the time of Provost Phelps and then Sir David Ross. So it was a sort of natural choice, really, that I would apply to Oriel, and fortunately they accepted me.
Mm.
And I came up for the interview, and I was interviewed by the classics tutor, Reggie Burton, in his lovely rooms over in Third Quad. And I remember it was about half an hour of interview. We sat down, we started chatting, and we soon discovered that we had a mutual interest in the novels of Jane Austen. We were both Janeites. And we spent the entire time talking about Jane Austen, nothing about classics at all. So I always say it's my knowledge of Jane Austen that got me into Oxford. But in those days, that's a sort of indicator, really, I think, of how less pressured things were in those days. You know, it wasn't a question of getting 4A stars at A level. I think I got an ABC or ABB or something like that. It was much more laid back, and I don't think the college at that particular point in the early 60s was particularly academically brilliant. It wasn't in the league of someone like Balliol, but there were a number of dons, Reggie Burton being one of them, who'd been here for some considerable time. And of course the provost himself, Turpin. They'd all been at Oriel for some time, or well established, and there was this great sort of sense of a very stable SCR, urbane but also quite homely. I think Reggie was a great SCR man. So there was that very strong collegiate feel then. A number of fellows did live in. So you got that sense of a fellowship who really were focused on the college and enjoyed being part of the college.
So was that a friendly sort of feeling? Was it an inclusive sort of familial feeling, or did it seem more exclusive?
I think it was benign. Undergraduates in those days, I should have said, of course, when I was up, the college was all male. You felt, well, I'm not sure when the age of majority changed from 21 to 18, but I think we were still 21 then. So technically we were still children. And I think there was a feeling by the fellowship, the governing body, that they were the ones in charge. We were the undergraduates, they were the teachers, we were the taught. That, of course, was one of the reasons for the emerging student unrest that came about during the time I was here. Not just in Oxford, of course. 1968 was the year of revolution, wasn't it? In Paris, in Berlin, in America, there were ferment on student campuses, and Oxford shared a bit in that, in a slightly more genteel way. There were occupations, sort of the Clarendon building was occupied by students in protest about something to do with university administration. I can remember there was an occasion here in Oriel, there'd been discussion, the college was intending to increase its charges to undergraduates, and the undergraduates got together and had a motion against this, and Guy Mansfield, who was the president of the JCR, came to a governing body meeting to present this letter from the student body, which was received, and I think Guy Mansfield was allowed into the meeting to present it, but the demands were then rejected by the governing body, at which point some of the undergraduates stormed into the SCR where the governing body was holding its meeting, and the provost adjourned the meeting. So, you know, we too tasted a bit of the revolutionary fervour of the time. There were quite a lot of, frankly, pretty extreme demands, almost saying, we, the undergraduates, must dictate to you how the college is run. But I think it was all part of that sense of people wanting to take more responsibility, saying, look, you know, we're not just children, we are adults, and we want to say, you know, we're part of this community of scholars, and we want to say in how, even a small say, in how things are run.
Oriel has some reputation for being quite conservative, not admitting yes. women for another 2 decades after this, but do you feel...
I can remember, about the time I came up, 1966, was the time when the college was starting to admit more grammar school and comprehensive school undergraduates from not just the southeast of England, but from the Midlands, the north. And I can well remember, you could tell who the public school people were and who the non-public school people were. Because the public school people, and I have to say, I myself included, tended to wear grey flannels and sports jacket, collar and tie. And the non-public school people would tend to wear informal clothes, jeans, you know, less dressy, as it were. I can remember, it's just sort of just one of those little memories lodged in the mind, that you just noticed there was this distinction in how people dressed that betrayed the background they'd come from. And obviously that's changed over time a lot. But there were, at that time, Oriel had quite a lot of closed scholarships to Harrow and one or two other public schools. I'm not sure over the last sort of 20, 30 years how that sort of conservatism, traditionalism has manifested itself, but I don't think Oriel was any different when I came up. Oriel was any different particularly from many of the other colleges. I mean, it may have admitted more public school boys than others, I don't know, but I've heard the tag Toriel, you know, Oriel is a kind of Tory college, or that it's very traditionalist, somewhat reactionary. I'm not sure that's actually a fair assessment. It's more traditionalist, I think, than some colleges in the sense that there are, as far as the SCR are concerned, there are 2 formal guest nights. I think some colleges, you know, SCR guest nights have sort of almost vanished. There are formal halls, and undergraduates wear the boys' collar and tie, and girls wear smart clothes, and all wear gowns. That's probably pretty unusual now amongst the colleges. Personally, I think it's rather nice, because one of the distinctive marks of Oxford is its traditions, its way of dressing and so on, and if you lose it, it's gone forever. So in that sense of wanting to retain some of the traditions, I think it's a good thing. The negative side, I suppose, is if it's perceived, the college is perceived to be too snobbish or unwelcoming to people from non-public school backgrounds, or has a culture in which people are made to feel they don't fit in. But I think on the whole, I've been told that it's, you know, it's seen also, it may have this Toriel image, but it's also known as a friendly college.
So are there any traditions that you remember existing in your time in the 60s that no longer exist?
There's one tradition that was somewhat associated with the boat club, and that is sconcing in hall, in formal hall. There are all sorts of reasons you could get sconced. Not wearing the proper dress in hall was one. Making a mistake when saying the college grace before the meal was also another. You just said, "I sconce you." Then you had to, I mean, you could say no, you could decline, but that would have been to lose a lot of face. And then you had to drink from the sconce pot straight down without the sconce pot leaving your lip. And that was a pretty disgusting kind of habit, really. I'm not sure when that stopped, but it certainly doesn't happen now. The year I matriculated was also the year that Oriel went head of the river for the first time in 90 years or something. And since then, you know, it has very much kept its reputation for excellence in rowing. The boat club was therefore, when I was up, a very important part of college life. I think I rowed in one of those sort of, you know, fun eights, which weren't taken seriously. So I certainly wasn't a rower in the you know, proper sporting sense. But they did exercise a strong influence in the college. And there were, you know, the Mr. Phillips, who was the steward then, who I think was a steward in all for about 30 years. He was a great supporter of the boat club. He'd make sure they got top quality food in all. They'd have special meals provided for them. The bursar, I think, of the time, was very keen on maintaining the rowing prowess of the college. That was a... And of course, that's still the same now, isn't it? The Oriel Tortoise was another... I remember we had Testudo, who then gave birth to another tortoise, and had the college arms painted on his shell, and you'd see him crawling slowly around one of the quads. So that's another thing that's gone. But otherwise, you know, things, the sort of outward things you've noticed, like, do undergraduates wear gowns? Yes, they still do. So you always had to wear a gown for your tutorial. I'm not sure whether that's still the case. The culture was very different. As I said, it was an all-male college, but the gate shut at 9 o'clock at night. You could then ring the bell between 9 and 12, and the porter would let you in. But after 12, that was it. You could not get into college. The gate was locked, and you either stayed out or climbed in. And if you were caught climbing in, you were up before the dean. The best route was over by the Magpie Lane, by the toilets. One ghastly experience in this very room. The chaplain at that time was Dr. Dilliston, who was a former dean of Liverpool Cathedral, a very learned churchman, lovely man. I think he probably lived in college at that time, so these were his, not just his rooms for study, but he had a collection of porcelain in a cabinet that was very dear to him. He was a collector, quite knowledgeable about porcelain. And one of the boat club climbed up the drain pipe to get in, because they must have seen that his window was open or something. Got in, put the foot through the cabinet and smashed this collection of porcelain. That did not go down well. Then, as now, bad behaviour was often associated with the boat club, I'm afraid. Whether it was heavy drinking or larking around or whatever. You know, it was a much more... what I'm talking about doesn't just refer to Oriel. I mean, all colleges had the same rules. They were much more enclosed communities. And you tended to make your friends much more within your own college rather than outside it. Obviously, you'd meet people within your own subject, but it would be people on your staircase or, you know, people you met in the course of socialising that became your friends. And I think now that's probably changed a bit in that people probably socialise much more widely across the university than they... The other thing is that in the days when I was up, the college accommodation simply couldn't take everybody. You knew you would have to spend 1 or 2 years in digs. And student digs in those days, you know, you had a landlady who and you'd have a room in her house and she'd cook you breakfast. That's what most undergraduates... It was much rarer then for, say, 3 or 4 undergraduates to band together and say, let's hire a property. It tended to be the wealthier ones who did that. Most people went into digs. So, and now, of course, there's a much greater emphasis on the college housing everybody, if they want to, for the whole of their time, whether it's on the main site or a hostel.
So has the material nature of the college changed very much since your time?
Oh, very little. Externally, the college has now refurbished the Rhodes Building, so that's much smarter than it used to. Internally, rooms have been upgraded. People have ensuite facilities now that they never did. There were communal showers and baths. I remember in staircase three, or I don't think we had toilets in lavatories in the rooms. I started off on staircase two at the top, and it was one of those sitting rooms with a shared sitting room with two small bedrooms off it. So, you know, it was much more like a sort of public school, really. And you'd have to go down, walk across with your towel and wash bag and over to the showers. And whereas now, you know, all those facilities have been hugely upgraded. And also, the other change is that the system of scouts, we've still got scouts, but they're largely, almost entirely, aren't they, women? Whereas when I was up, it was largely men. The men who were often families who'd been, you know, whose families had been scouts at the college before them. So it was a sort of family tradition to be in the college. And the scout would, if you wanted a meal in your room, if you wanted to entertain guests in your room, a scout would actually organise that, which was a sort of hangover from the pre-war days when scouts, you know, you had coal fires in your room and a scout would bring you a bowl and to wash in the morning and bring you your commons, bread and cheese and a glass of beer. So there was a bit of a hangover of that. There was a bit of a construction boom in the 60s. Quite a lot of colleges who had the land to do it built new quadrangles and new residential blocks and so on. We've never had the land, you know, we're landlocked. What we do have is the island site. Now, when I was up in the 60s, the island site was a complete warren. Some students lived there, the MCR was there, the real tennis court was still there, but it was disgusting. So a lot of, well, obviously, you know, that's changed a lot. And the real tennis court's gone and the Harris Lecture Theatre is in its place. And of course, it's actually revealed some of the lovely early buildings going back to the medieval period, which are concealed on that site. I haven't really talked about the chapel. I was quite involved in the chapel. Chapel life then wasn't as active, I have to say, as it is now. There weren't as many services, or as many things going on. And the chaplain, Dr. Dilliston, was a fellow, but I think most provosts were pretty supportive of the chapel. It's very clear now, coming back 50 years later, that the position of institutional religion in Oxford is much more marginalised, I think. You get the sense of chapels and chaplains having to fight their corner much more to justify their existence. And it's quite clear that there are always, at any one time, those who don't see the point of a chapel and a chaplain in today's world, and would rather, you know, the money was spent on something else, and, you know, the chapel space was utilised for, I don't know, more library space or car park or whatever. So I think it's a tougher place that we're in now. Back in the earlier years of the 20th century, the chapel clearly was one of the focal points of college life. Chapel attendance was compulsory for the undergraduate body. Everyone had to go. Choral Evensong on a Sunday was the sort of pivot of the whole week, and quite a lot of the fellows would come to it. And certainly I can remember in the 60s the chapel was better attended by fellows than it is now. We had a choir then, and it was a mixed choir. Some girls from St Hilda's came and joined in, but we sang from up in the organ loft. So that released the space downstairs, and I remember it usually being sort of comfortably filled. But then again, I know, you know, you have an Advent carol service, which is packed. So people will come, but I just get the sense that organised religion, the Christian religion, in its institutional form within colleges, has to fight its own corner a bit more than it ever used to. And although here, I have to say, you know, I'm part of the welfare team, and I think probably the chaplain is seen as quite an important pastoral figure. As far as I can remember, there simply was not. Obviously, there were individuals who suffered from depression or exam pressure and went off the rails or whatever. But I just don't remember there being such an emphasis on anxiety and stress that there seems to be around now. And I think that's probably, there's a number of reasons for that. One is that students come up to Oxford now, having come through an educational system that tests them. You know, there's endless testing, and I think a lot of pressure, conscious and subconscious, from parents to step up to the mark, do well, make the grade. So I think students arrive stressed in a way that they didn't 50 years ago. And there may be other pressures in society generally, but another thing is that when I was an undergraduate, I was part of less than 10% of the population who went on to higher education. So we were the sort of elite, if you like. Nowadays, it's what nearly 50% of the population goes on to higher education. And particularly, you know, coming out with an Oxford degree, you didn't worry about a job. I mean, there'd be a whole range of jobs you could look at. So there was no sense of, golly, I've got to get a really good degree result, and maybe then I've got to go on and do a further degree because, you know, the job I'm looking for wants someone who's not just got a BA but got a an MPhil or an MSc or something as well. We were pretty confident there'd be a job. It was just a question of choosing which, you know, teaching, civil service, industry, creative arts, you know, whatever it might be. So there wasn't that pressure, and not many people in my generation went on to do higher degrees anyway. You know, most undergraduates, when they got their degree, they left and they got a job. And you only stayed on to do your DPhil or whatever it was, if you were wanting to get into the academic world seriously and teach and you know, stay on in academia. But now, a lot of people, I think, do another degree. It's sad, really, to see how much stress there is around, but the corollary of that is that the welfare provision now is much, much better than it was when I was around. I mean, when I was up, there was the dean, who was largely a disciplinary figure. There was your tutor, who was supposed to have a kind of pastoral role, and some were better at it than others. And there was the college doctor. And that was it. You know, we do now have this, I think, a very good welfare team. I feel the college has a real sense of wanting to do the best for its undergraduates and to be there for them in whatever way is appropriate. But again, going back to our earlier comments, I mean, one of the different things now is that the college is sort of in loco parentis, but isn't. All the undergraduates are over the age of majority, they're all adults. So the college can't be too heavy-handed, but it does have responsibility for people's welfare. And I think on the whole, they seem to discharge it pretty well.
Well, I'm going to take a break from the narrative of Oxford's history now to see for myself one of those aureal traditions that seems to have survived until this very day. It's now the last Saturday in May. You find me in Oriel College, and I seem to have stumbled upon one of those old Oxford traditions that makes this place seem so quaint to outsiders, but here seem to pass with little comment or question. It's summer eights, and I'm told that Oriel are head of the river, and that this provides the explanation for the raucous ritual that I'm about to witness. Well, let's go and see what happens. For those not in the know, summer eights is Oxford's most prestigious intercollegiate rowing competition, and for the third year in a row, it seems that Oriel have just won. What I witnessed was their way of celebrating. An old boat was carried into the quad, to loud acclamation, and laid to rest in front of the entrance to the hall. Several prominent numbers of the college then proceeded to break the boat, puncturing it with shovels, and stuffing the holes with newspaper. Then the whole thing was roped off, and most of the onlookers having dwindled away, left for a while to peace and quiet, while the rowers enjoyed a rowdy and apparently very alcoholic meal in hall. Soon after sunset, the quad was again filled by most of the college's members as the rowers staggered out down the steps from their vociferous dinner. with very little ceremony and very many cheers, shouts, and slurred songs, the newspaper was set light to, and very soon the whole boat was ablaze. The assembled stood, warmed further by the college's success, quite literally, on what had already been a sweltering sunny day, and simply watched it burn, seemingly oblivious when the wind wafted the wood and varnish smoke into their faces, until a pile of smouldering ashes was all that remained. But what can we say about Oxford even before this? Is there anyone around who remembers it as far back as the first half of the 20th century? Well, none of the fellows or former students I've been able to come across go back quite that far. But in 1940, with the nation plunged into war, one young lady found herself in the heart of the action on the home front, right here in Oxford. You might think that the university had been shut down by the war, but far from it. It turns out that Jean Davidson, now aged 93, has a whole album of interesting memories to share with us.
It was the second year of the war, because when the war was declared, I was a tender 16 and a half years old, and I had no knowledge of how I could use my abilities in the war. So I thought the best thing I could do is get some skills that are going to be universally acceptable. Very superior crash course in being a high-powered secretary. The number of people who could do that were not the dons. They had absolutely no skills at all, my dear darling dons. An academic don would usually be leading a team of people who are interested in a very specific subject. Now, I didn't come across many Oriel dons, but the first Oriel don I met was Father Stuffy, and then I found he would really much rather divert me into a sort of playgirl. He was a historian, and he was a good historian, much liked, but his contribution to the war, I should think, was negligible, but I never saw him once I realized he really was more interested in seeing me as a plaything than doing any serious work, you see. So I said goodbye to Oriel quite early in my career, which is a shame. Now, if you imagine the Oxford you know, there is a very central road which runs right through the city, which is Holywell Lane. That was the hub of the meeting place, everybody. They were training their undergrads very specifically in the subjects which would be useful. Everything had to be diverted, not just to be useful, to have a degree and learn something, but to have it so that it could be used the moment they left, because they were all going to have to go on after they'd taken their degrees to be soldier, sailor, air force, or whatever. They weren't going to get away by just saying, I'm Don. That wasn't the point. They had to be Don who could contribute to the war effort. The war effort consumed us, because we knew that it was going to be the brains of England that would win the war. It wasn't going to be all our beef and strength and that. It was going to be cunning, extra knowledge about this and that and t'other, and making of spies. We had to make good spies. That was a very difficult thing. Making a spy, you see, it's very, very fascinating. And they had to be very special people. And I got to know a lot of spies. Why my life became so particularly lovely, I started off in some very boring digs up the Banbury Road, where I encountered the worst kind of people who thought they were contributing to the war effort. Every light bulb was painted green, so we wouldn't consume much electricity. And if you ate a piece of cake late at night, it was very carefully marked round. This cake, bit of cake, was eaten by Jean at bottom of an hour. So, yes. So you felt you had very little freedom and liked to have a cup of tea and a piece of cake.
Because everything was rationed, I suppose.
Everything. It was rationing was incredibly strong. And very rightly so, really. It wasn't coming in the ordinary. You see, everybody who had been, if you think of it, the people who could engage in agriculture were extremely useful people, because they could go off and have farm and they could grow lovely crops. So they were all very good people, but they didn't come to university, because the university was not run for any agricultural schemes, not at all at all. It was how to use it after it had been made if they needed it. And of course they had every level of cleverness, because math came into everything, everything. Always calculations, calculations, calculations. Would this do, would that do, would do it better? All was calculated mathematically. So the maths colleges, and there's a big, is it Queen's?
Because you said a lot of the colleges were closed.
A lot were closed. Queen's, I think, stayed open because of its excellent dons of maths. Mm. And it had some very good undergrads there, very, very bright people. They were only allowed to remain in the colleges if they had the potential of providing something that the ordinary world, I mean the ordinary world, England and everybody else, could not provide. It was a provision, really. We were providing something that was necessary. So sciences did well, and now Balliol was all right, because Balliol still had very bright people. And I think they probably skimmed the best of the people who made approaches to the colleges to become undergrads. They skimmed the cream, and the rest were allowed just to disappear nowhere. They only wanted the crème de la crème of all these brains, you see. It was the brain they were after. So it made them interesting people, but they had very little else to offer except their brain. That was what was necessary. And that's what was well fed, well looked after. And I'm sure if I'd been in one of those, I'd find it very hard, because they weren't doing normality at all. So for me, I would have been out of place in Queen's, definitely, and Oriel. But it was which professors were allowed to stay on and not called up. A lot had to go against their wishes and just go and do ordinary things, like fight. And it was a sad blow to them that it happened. They weren't chosen to stay, because they, obviously their whole career had been centred on the university of their choice. So you could just imagine the academic side of life was very low, except a few top notchers. Now the top notchers that I knew were in Magdalen for one, Merton for another, and Univ. They seemed to dominate Oxford during the war. I've never quite discovered how they worked their family lives out, but I think most of them had perfectly ordinary houses up somewhere like the Banbury Road. Very few of them had rooms which would accommodate wives. That wasn't on. We didn't have a wife. Once you worked through the door, your wives had disappeared into the grill. But to come back to where I was working, and this is pure chance, this is the loveliest thing, front of all, chance. I had a father who was totally naval and had no interest in the universities whatsoever. He said, well, what are you going to do now? I said, Pa, I'm going to the Admiralty. He said, why? I said, well, I thought you'd be pleased, you're a sailor. And dear Pa said, not much hope for you, girl. He sent me off thinking, you'll be lucky, you know, they don't want things like you. They want some really bright sparks. I said, well, wait and see, Pa, don't condemn it straight away. Because he was already a well-known sailor, done all sorts of lovely, exciting things. So, off I trod, and I banged on the door more or less. I said, do come in. They said, why are you here? He said, I'd like very much to work for something to do with the university during the war. Can you do anything? Not a lot. Are you prepared to have a try? Yes. Certainly I'll try. And they said, well, we'll give you an exam here and now. I said, is this how you usually behave? They said, yes, if we think that you might have some hope of helping us. So I sat an exam of some description, general knowledge, I suppose, and then they had to read a piece to me, and could I read it back instantly, you know, absolutely instantly, without making a mistake. I was just 17. Yes. They enter university at 17.
Well, usually 18.
18. Anyway, I was there most of the morning, and they said, are you prepared to go anywhere? And I said, yes. That's the point of the war. You see new places and new ways of life. So, yes, of course I'm prepared to go. 5 days later, I received a telephone call saying, Jean, are you prepared to go to Oxford? I said, yes. Why Oxford? He said, well, we've got lots of interesting jobs on at Oxford at the moment, and a lot of our general intelligence work for the whole of the forces is now centred in Oxford. And from that we radiate out information to wherever information is required. So you might get anything to find out. You don't know whether you're going to be working with a spy or just a bit of very, very clever bit of work on what's going to happen. Are you prepared to sort of work? They said, you will have to work rather hard, and you won't get paid very much, and you'll have to find your own digs and make your own way. And I said, that's all right. That seems like life to me. So at that moment, I walked in, and I thought, where am I going to live? How do you find somewhere to live? This is where I found this dreadful man with the cake tin, which was so funny. I thought, I can't do that. I really cannot bear that. So I knew one other girl who said, oh, why don't you come down with me? I'm behind Magdalen at Hollywell Ford. Now Hollywell, as you know, is the stream which runs really under Magdalen. A very attractive situation to be in, or down by the river. And Hollywell Ford turned out to be a big house, and in that lived A.J.P. Taylor, his family, and his abundance of friends. I said, well, how did you get in? She said, I knocked on the door, and this very charming man came out, A.J.P. himself. He said, what are you interested in? She said, I'm interested in doing what I can for the work. But I would love somewhere nice and interesting to live and meet interesting people. He said, walk in. And then she introduced me to him too. And he said, would you really like to live here, Jean? And I said, oh, I should be absolutely so pleased to live in your house. Because he had two charming children, lovely children, Giles and Sebastian. And he had this dotty wife, Margaret, who never got up to 11. And he was just such an energetic and delicious man to talk to, because his brain was working on all different levels, and he would be able to tell an absolutely update on how the war was going over breakfast, if you wanted to know. He would know every academic don there was in the university. And did they fight? They hated each other, those academic dons. Oh, how they hated each other. They were terrified one was going to write a better paper than the other. It was priceless. But I was so fortunate, because once I'd walked through that door, the whole of the war changed for me. Because I wasn't doing just war work. I was actually seeing the university and understanding how much it was contributing to the life of our country. It kept up a tremendous energy the whole of the war, Magdalen. and many, many very intelligent people went there, even for a short time, to get a bit more academically secure before they went off on whatever they were going to do. And you will say, well, what was my line? What did I do? I found myself belonging to something called ISTD, Inter-Service Topographical Department, NID, Naval Intelligence Division 6, you see. This was in one of the rather strange religious colleges which were shut down. There's a road running just above Holywell, and that college was shut, and they allowed us to occupy it. And huge huts were built opposite us, so they could get masses of people working. Rather, what I imagine, obviously I've not been to work there, but imagine it was rather like Bletchley in some way, that there were little huts for every type of subject that was being discussed. And as we were doing spy work for the Navy, that's exactly what it was, and writing up reports about what they would discover if they went here, there, or anywhere. And they had to get on with the navies of all the other countries we were in league with, you see. I think it was the French that had the greatest difference. Well, that you can imagine was important, because we were planning to go back to France, weren't we? The whole of the thing was to get us back to France. You know, our whole energy was based on we've got to recapture our lands in France. Now, in the midst of all this, you went when you first knocked on the door thinking you were talking to a very intelligent professor, because he was relaxed, he was easy, he was charming. He said, oh, come on in, Jean. And I have no rules in this house, except you come nowhere near my friends after 5 o'clock in the evening. I said, why is that? He said, well, we start really talking then. And I will have friends who I don't want you to hear discussing the problems of whatever they want to discuss. So you've got to get out of the way and not be seen, keep out of the light. And Margaret, his wife, she was a musician. And she kept the music of Oxford alive throughout the war. Wonderful. Because she arranged concerts in the town hall every Saturday. So that was Oxford had a really, really lively musical base, really. And we had a lot of rooms down in Holywell which were devoted to music of all sorts. And people would go, and it was great fun, you used to join in and go to a discussion group, all on specific subjects of music at a very high level, because they were all musicians themselves. And you could learn an enormous amount about music by just devoting yourself to the work. I thought they'd call it down there, but it was in Holywell itself. And it was the music rooms. And you went down there and they played recordings, of course, on rather bad tapes and things. But it was, again, very wonderful to meet people who were high-powered in music and really understood what they were talking about. And nobody questioned whether you were any good or not. If you were enjoying it and you were able to contribute in some way, you were welcomed. So I learnt more about music than I could have ever, ever dreamt of learning being anywhere else. So I was blessed by getting music suddenly into my life like that. Can you imagine anything so exciting? We were allowed to have our own funny old gramophones in our room, of course. Gramophones. Do you remember the word, gramophone?
Oh yes, I still use gramophones myself, and I'm quite old-fashioned.
Well, gramophones were wonderful. And of course we all collected music, because you could still buy these lovely recordings. And if any of the musicians came up to Margaret's standard, she would invite them to stay at Holywell Ford and discuss music. So you might suddenly find yourself next to some quite brilliant musician, talking to her, because she was quite clever in music and nothing else. And I realised that I could never be bored, ever, ever, ever be bored in that place, because there was always somebody staying, who you might or might not have breakfast with, and then you would disappear out of their lives, and you would never, never have a meal with them again. It was only breakfast. Sometimes they came to lunch, because poor old AJP had to cook our lunch for us himself.
Himself?
Himself! And he grew all the vegetables himself!
Oh, good for him.
Brilliant man. And mostly baked the bread. Yes, he did that.
Have to find time for doing any work.
Well, you do wonder, don't you? His afternoons were shut in his study. Because he was working, but I don't think his contribution was very close to the war, somehow. Because he knew what I was doing, and he certainly never mentioned the war, except that we found he had this extraordinary skill, and it was a skill which I had never met before. He could, if required, speak on a subject of the war without a note, and he would do this about once a month and go to London, and with a radio broadcast he would describe some aspect of the war which fascinated people, and he knew all about that. But when he went to London, he went without a note, and he delivered his lecture over the radio, of course, and the England almost came to a stop. You had to hear what his view was about how things were going in the war, because he knew so much. Because he had friends in all the different slightly associated countries, the border countries, who were on the fringe of having to fight the Germans, but not quite involved. He made marvellous friends of people, and they were all floating about his house too. In every evening, anybody who was fed up with the boring chatter in college, they did chatter on, you know. They would come up and spend the evening with Margaret playing very good trumpet kind of, you know, the sort of trumpet they had on gramophones in those days. It would come out through the trumpet, and only she could turn it on and turn it off. But the people sitting around listening to this music would all be absolutely top musicians themselves in some way or another. And that made her very happy. What made her very unhappy was that she was supposed to help AJP cook supper. Well, she said she always said she was far too busy talking to her musician friends to cook. But there was some frightful rows. They had some terrible rows. We were not supposed to listen in, but we could hear them. And of course, Margaret just added to the joys of life of having in the hut in the grounds, she had Dylan Thomas,
really?
As a lover, which was quite surprising. I never met Dylan Thomas because he was told to stay in his shed.
So what were all these poets doing in the war then?
That was the interesting thing. What were the poets doing? Many of them were injured. Some were there purely to help to record the intellectual life through poetry, and they wanted people like that still to be recording what it was like through poetry. And I'm sure our house was the most mixed up job you could ever, ever come across. Who today is going to be able to walk out into Oxford and find a house filled with such a mixture of life? Now, you see, he was very funny with me, because I used to go out most nights dancing. And one of the people I danced with was one of his pupils. And he would say, oh, Dickie, you can't go with that man. I hope his feet are more nimble than his brain. Yet he dances beautifully, thank you very much. He said, well, if you like it, fine by me. But he was connected to Princess Elizabeth. He was the son of Princess Elizabeth's own private secretary. And that's why he was allowed to come amongst all this war work. Because he obviously wouldn't have given the show away, as you might say. Because we knew an awful lot of what was going on. Because every morning a girl from Medenham, which was an Air Force base, would arrive on a motorbike with great panniers either side of her. And in that would be all the dispatches from all the different areas of intelligence. And we had them all there in front of us. And we had to sort it all out and make sure the right person read the right bit and used it in the right way. So although we were insignificant, we were the centre of knowledge about the progress of the war. Definitely we knew too much. If anybody had got hold of us, and we would have been able to give awful information away. Yes, we had to be very careful about secrets. And I never told him, as AJP, one secret about the war. But somehow or other he knew more than we did. I don't know how he got it, but he got it. And then this wonderful voice would come over on the radio. You still had quite a few bright lads left in order. And of course dinner at night was very special, because if you were at the high table, then they all started talking their intellectual talk.
So they still had these formal dinners then
going on? They did. They still did it. They still did it. And he loved it. He absolutely adored it. He met everybody he wanted to know in going to these lovely dinners. But he was very, very, very kind, that he never tried to probe into anything I did. He never asked me a difficult question that I would be scared to answer. So he was very restrained, because he knew that we were fighting a war which was, we were dangerously close to losing. But he wanted to keep the war alive in Oxford, so that everybody there felt they were contributing to the war effort. And they did. They really did contribute. They were all clever, and some were really strikingly clever. So that what we were writing was looking probably a year ahead, because the great day was to get to that moment when we were going to move in and we would occupy France again.
Was it quite frightening during the wars, particularly say after the Battle of Britain, when it was so close to the RAF being beaten? And
yes, we were frightened, but we are very good at pretending we're not. When I knew that the war was on, was that one of my duties was certain nights I had to sleep under the roof, and I had a camp bed put up there for me, and a corporal brought me a mug of condensed milk tea. There I spent the night with a shovel and a little broom beside me, and if there was an air raid I had to shoot out onto the roof ready to jump at any nasty bomb that might have landed and tip it out over the
off the roof.
Yes. Talk about being innocent.
So they wouldn't necessarily explode straight away then, the bombs?
No, these were always fire bombs. They didn't want to destroy Oxford, they just wanted to burn it. So when we heard there was going to be a bomb raid on Oxford, what a palaver. We had to get all this precious information, which was stored so carefully, out into vans, and we drove out into the countryside where we spent the night in fields waiting till the bombing was over. But usually we knew when these attacks were coming, because our knowledge was good enough. They did not wish to destroy Oxford. Hitler had some very fine ideas what he was going to use it for, and he wanted it complete, but he did like to torment us by showing us that he could drop a few incendiaries on us, which would keep us alive, you know. But the intelligence work went on, and some of the most heroic stories come from the information that we were able to provide to the people who were going to be heroes. There's only one that I know really well, because I was involved in the making of that story. The Man Who Never Was. You ever heard that story?
No, but it sounds very intriguing.
Brilliantly constructed. Somebody had to pretend to be dead, and we had to know exactly how the tides would bring him in at a certain point, and the Germans would see this floating thing. It would be this man pretending to be dead, you see. And he would be carrying on him some very important papers, which would be so well carefully designed as to be look as if they were absolutely genuine papers from top headquarters. And then the Germans, poor silly idiots, read this and believe it, and divert their troops in a different direction. They got the wind of it eventually. They realised that we were hoaxing them a bit. And they didn't fall for it quite so often. We certainly did have enough successes to make it worthwhile. I had a great friend who knew a great deal more than me about this, because she had to pretend to be his girlfriend, and she had to write love letters to him, and he'd have those in his pocket. But it had to be somebody who had a good imagination who would write a very interesting letter, and then somebody else who could pretend to be a general or something, sending out instructions. All had to be done. Mm.
Did you ever worry that there was any sabotage going on, anyone working for the enemy?
I think we'd have known. I really do believe we would have known. I'm sure he would have, AJP would have known, if there was any really dangerous character walking around. But the only night that I remember feeling that it might be dangerous to be there was about five nights before we did invade France. I wasn't allowed to walk anywhere unless I had somebody fixed with a rifle. I couldn't leave the house without being guarded by this. And I thought, how stupid can you be to see me walking about with a thin man like this, with his guard, with his gun at the ready? It's telling everybody that something's going to happen, isn't it?
Yes.
How stupid! But still, they said, no, it's the rules. You've got to go out with this person. If you lived in London, it was probably more dangerous than going in a submarine. But my, oh my, those raids. They really knew how to put a bomb under you. Again, my father, he was a tough guy, he said, you've got to walk out in through London while the raid is at its height to see what it's like. I said, Pa, once again, must I? He said, well, you're not my daughter if you don't. So we solemnly walked through London with bombs flashing around us. Houses being blown down. Ugh, it was vile. Vile. He says, now you know what it's all about. Well, you've been out seeing what it's really like to be out amongst it and watch these houses fall down. But going home, if I'd come up from Oxford and I was going to spend the night in London, it was as black as night. It was black as night. Night is all right anyway. If you got out of the train, and I had to find my way to my grandmother's flat. The only way I could do it was to feel the stones of the houses. And I had to remember the sort of stone I was passing. And then eventually I would find the sort of stone I was looking for would show that I was nearing her flat. But there wasn't a light anywhere. I thought, this is a very odd thing to be doing. So many things were odd. But it just added to the pile of oddness. Normality, really. Mm. But not everybody had a father like mine who enjoyed danger.
Were you still in Oxford at the end of the war?
At the end of the war, I had met my husband-to-be. Went on, as you always do, you went on the river, and he rode very nicely, and we got quite friendly. And it wasn't long before we were engaged, and then it wasn't long before we were married, and then it wasn't long before the war ended. Then we went on to have more and more exciting lives after that. Having been used to excitement, we couldn't live a dull life, could we?